Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
My name is Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. It's always interesting to see who shows up for an 8:30 workshop. Strange group. So I feel right at home. I'd like to start off with something. This is a workshop on sponsorship, so we're going to talk about a lot of things about that, about where it came from, a little bit of the history of it, how it works, and because we're kind of a small group, maybe we'll get into some Q&A or give you guys a chance to express your opinion rather than just mine. And so what I'd like to do is I'd like to start off this with a two-minute meditation. And if you would, let's think about the people that were here when we got here. The people that were kind to us, somebody that got us a cup of coffee, showed us the ropes and helped us find a seat in the meeting and maybe called us unsolicited just to see how we were doing. Those people that really kept us here. Most of us don't really remember what they said to us, but we sure remember how we were treated. And it was rough out there for a long time, and you walk into AA, and AA to me is a very safe place. It should be a very safe place, and mostly I think it is. So let's think about those people, maybe just give a little thanks or just picture their faces in our memory. We'll do it for a couple of minutes. Thank you. It was a quick 2 minutes, wasn't it? So our topic this morning is sponsorship. I get to do this a lot around the country, which is a real gift. Visit different places, go to different places, and talk to people and do some workshops. And I got sober in Southern California, in the South Bay. I live in Torrance. And it is a hotbed of sobriety. There is birthday singing and cakes, and everybody claps after everybody shares, and it's just kind of a zoo. And that's my home. That's my culture. That's where I got sober. So when I go around the country, and they're not singing happy birthday, and they're not clapping, and they're not, I go, what is wrong with these people? I've walked into Alano clubs and actually seen a sign on the wall that says, "We don't care how you do it in California." Because I think they think we're a little pushy and arrogant, you know, and probably some truth to that. But here in Phoenix, I understand that it's much the same. I get down here, my family's from here, and I've been down here quite a bit. And in our part of the country, in our area, there is a real ethic of sponsorship. It's real hard to go to meetings, where I'm from anyway, where that is not talked about. Get a sponsor, work the steps, go to lots of meetings. You hear that incessantly. In other parts of the country, it's not really the case. There is a movement afoot. Wally P., my buddy, back to basics. And people will talk about the fact that we've lost our edge. That our success rate isn't what it once was. That we're not as effective as we used to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's completely wrong. I think we're as effective and as dynamic and aggressive and successful as we've ever been. And we'll talk about that a little bit. I'll give you a reason why I feel that way. Alcoholics Anonymous came from an organization called the Oxford Group. Bill and Bob were both members of the Oxford Group. The way Bill met Bob was through the Oxford Group. Henrietta Sieberling was Ann Smith's sponsor in the Oxford Group. When they got together and Bob finally stopped drinking, they went to Oxford Group meetings. They were the alcoholic squad of the Oxford Group. Bill Wilson was kicked out of the Oxford Group in New York. The reason he was kicked out of the Oxford Group is because he wasn't maximum. They wanted him as part of the businessman's group because he was a stock speculator and he had a lot of connections in Wall Street. And they wanted him to work within that community to try to bring people into the organization. And all Bill wanted to do was work with those drunks. So they kicked him out. When the first meeting started, they were having meetings in Akron at, T. Henry's house. And the meetings got too large. They were bringing in too many drunks. Most of them weren't staying sober. So they finally started a meeting in King's School, which I believe is still going on in Akron. And Clarence Snyder down in Cleveland was the first guy to start a meeting called Alcoholics Anonymous. They weren't so connected to the Oxford Group. But the Oxford Group teaching was one-on-one evangelism, they called it. They called themselves soul surgeons. And what they would do, they didn't gather people together in large tents and try to convert them. They weren't really a church. They were a non-denominational Christian organization. But they were a movement. They had aspirations. They wanted to change the world. They're still around today. They're called Initiatives of Change. I visited their place in Co, Switzerland last year. It's just remarkable. They're still an active, vibrant organization. And so when they formed Alcoholics Anonymous, they went with what they knew. The Oxford Group had house parties where they shared. They gave testimony. And they each one shared their story. They lined people up together, people with similar problems or similar issues, even if they weren't called problems. They would say, well, why don't you two get together and meditate together? And what they would do, these two people, the sponsor and the sponsee, would sit and meditate. They would have an issue or something that they were concerned about, possibly. And they would meditate for a period of time, and they would have a pad and a paper. And after they got done with the meditation, they sat down and they wrote out what God said to them. Because they fully expected to receive an answer. Then, just to be careful, they shared that with each other to make sure it wasn't the devil. You know? Cleared it through somebody else, you know? And they had four steps. A lot of times you hear it talked about six steps, but there were really only four. And they added a couple before the book was ever written. So Wilson and Smith went with what they knew. This is what they knew. Wilson was very open about the fact that all of one day at a time, God as you understand God, all that stuff came from the Oxford Group. There are some really interesting books written where you can take the big book and then apply it to Oxford Group writings, and it's just plagiarism, you know. The 12 and 12, which our speaker last night was the first time I'd ever heard anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous talk so much about the 12 and 12 and actually read from it from a podium. Some would consider that heresy. But the 12 and 12 is a very different document, isn't it? I mean, if you've read it, I mean, it's 15 years after he got sober, and mostly it's about his defects of character. Mr. Wilson, you can track his life through AA writing, you know, because he wrote about himself, and that's why we identify with him. We're very similar to him. Well, in the 1940s, after the book came out, when they wrote the book, Wilson actually went to Sam Shoemaker, who was the minister of Calvary Chapel, and he said, "Sam, we need to write a book. I want you to write it." Because Shoemaker was very prolific, real charismatic. Billy Graham said about Sam Shoemaker, "If Sam Shoemaker hadn't have died of cancer in the early 60s, you would have never heard of me." Shoemaker was a big deal in the United States. He was the head of the Oxford Group movement in the U.S. He was Episcopalian minister. Spoke a lot on college campuses and stuff, and he was just a... And this is, I can wander off into the history of AA, but he had a lot to do with the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think probably more than anybody, he was Wilson's sponsor, somebody that Wilson really listened to. Well, he went to Sam and he said, "Write the book." Shoemaker, in his brilliance, said, "No, Bill, this is your gig. You know, you do it. I'll help, but you can do this." And so Wilson sat down and started doing it, and as you know, they passed it around, they kind of edited it, and they softened it up. Well, the 75% success rate comes from the foreword to the second edition, and it talks about 75% of the people get sober, 50% sober up right away and stay that way, another 25% after a slip or two they get sober, and the other 25% show improvement. And where do you get the statistics? You get these statistics from a failed stock speculator, a shaky-handed proctologist, who they pretty much kept out of the loop. Bob was just working with people. "Bill, you go ahead and promote, and I'm going to go over here." And Hank Parkhurst, who was a used car salesman. These are the guys that came up with phony stock certificates to Works Publishing to try to raise money. And some of those are still floating around. And so 75%, how do they know? How do they know 75%? 1939, they wrote the book, and they sent it out there, and they called the steps suggestions, which any of us that have been around a while know that that's bullshit. You know, you pretty much have to do something if you want to stay around here. But they called them suggestions. They said "we" instead of "you." They softened it. They softened it. And they sent it out there, hoping to get people to respond. This was a sales tool. And I think unabashedly so. I mean, this is what they wanted. They wanted to get. They knew they had something really worthwhile. And they wanted to market it. Remember, his idea was to build hospitals from one end of the country to the other, which has pretty much happened. Not the way he envisioned it, but it's pretty much happened, hasn't it? I mean, recovery is an industry. It's an industry now. It's hip now. Who knew? You know? Well, in 1941, Bob Smith, old Bob over here just working with people, came up with an incredible document. It's called the Akron Manual. I've got a sign-up list here. If anybody would like to get copies of this stuff that I'm going to quote from, you put your name and email address, and I'll email it to you. The Akron Manual surfaced some years ago, and I believe this is what they were really doing compared to what was written in the book or what was known publicly. So I'm going to quote you a few little lines from the Akron Manual, which is, they're real eye-opening. This is written to the newcomer and to the sponsor. Another thing you hear, sponsorship is not mentioned in the big book. It is too. The big book is much bigger than 164 pages. People seem to forget that. there are stories in the back part of the book all about sponsorship. Explain that we are not in the business of sobering up drunks merely to have them go on another bender. Explain that our aim is total and permanent sobriety. What happened to one day at a time? Definition of an Alcoholic Anonymous. An Alcoholic Anonymous is an alcoholic who, through application of and adherence to the rules laid down by the organization, has completely forsworn the use of any and all alcoholic beverages. The moment he wittingly drinks so much as a drop of beer, wine, spirits, or any other alcoholic drink, he automatically loses all status as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is not interested in sobering up drunks who are not sincere in their desire to remain completely sober for all time. Not one time in this thing does it say one day at a time. And that's a pretty thick thing. Not once. There is no one day at a time in this thing. These guys were serious. To the newcomer, it is your life. It is your choice. If you are not completely convinced to your own satisfaction that you are an alcoholic, that your life has become unmanageable, if you are not ready to part with alcohol forever, it would be better for all concerned if you discontinued reading this and give up the idea of becoming a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sweet Dr. Bob. I remember when I first read this, I called my sponsor and went, "Whoa, dude! You can't believe this. These guys were cruel." A word to the sponsor. You must fulfill all pledges you make to him, either tangible or intangible. If you cannot fulfill a promise, do not make it. You have in your hands the most valuable property in the world, the future of a fellow man. Treat his life as carefully as you would your own. You are literally responsible for his life. Bit much. Alcoholics Anonymous is 100% effective for those who faithfully follow the rules. 100% effective. It is those who try to cut corners who find themselves back in their old drunken state. Before long, you will have a new thrill, the thrill of helping someone else. There is no greater satisfaction in the world than watching the progress of a new Alcoholic Anonymous. No whiskey in the world can give you this thrill. Above all, remember this. Keep the rules in mind. As long as you follow them, you are on firm ground, but the least deviation and you are vulnerable. As a new member, remember that you are one of the most important cogs in the machinery of AA. Without the work of the new member, AA could not have grown as it has. You will bring into this work a fresh enthusiasm, the zeal of a crusader. You will want everyone to share with you the blessings of this new life. You will be tireless in your efforts to help others, and it is a splendid enthusiasm. Cherish it as long as you can. That's a really beautiful paragraph, I think. I mean, this is what these guys were experiencing. They were out, they were going to hospitals, and they would go into a hospital, and they would go down the beds, and they would ask each one of these guys, "Do you want to stop drinking? Do you realize that you have a problem? Do you want to? We have a way out. Do you want to stop?" And if the guy said yes, they would bring him into a meeting. If he said no, they just went on to the next bed. So they culled him out. They didn't try to sell this thing to somebody that wasn't interested. If there was somebody sitting there that was really hurting, they would bring these guys out of the hospital. They'd start working with them, start talking with them, and they would get sober, and they would see their lives change. God, they were just pumped up. They weren't writing inventories. They were saving souls. Every day. What, can you imagine how exciting that must have been in the early days? When it was like, you know, 1 week you go to a meeting, there's five people there. You know, 3 weeks later, there's 15. And then two, three, 4 months later, there's 100. I mean, that's what it was happening. That's what was happening. Can you imagine the phone calls between Akron and New York? As they were trading ideas. They were talking about how do you convey this? They didn't know how to convey it. They did not know how to convey it, especially before the book. They didn't have any structure. They just knew that they were sober. And that they sat down, they talked with each other. Remember, Wilson came from New York where he was dragging people to his apartment. And they were just drinking. He never saved a soul. Silkworth told him, quit preaching religion and tell your story. The non-alcoholic told him, shut up, Bill. You know, I don't think they want to hear about Jesus, you know. And there's nothing worse than a born-again agnostic, you know, that goes out there. Or a recovered smoker, you know. Or somebody who's suddenly become vegetarian, you know. Not that any of us identify with them. For you are ready to sponsor some poor alcoholic who is desperately in need of help, both human and divine. So God bless you. I love this one. This is great. This is the capper, I think, really. You aren't very important in this world. If you lose your job, someone better will replace you. If you die, your wife will mourn briefly and then remarry. Your children will grow up and you will be but a memory. In the last analysis, you are the only one who benefits by your sobriety. Seek to cultivate humility. Remember that cockiness leads to a speedy fall. Medical men will tell you that alcoholics are all alike in at least one respect. They are emotionally immature. In other words, alcoholics have not learned to think like adults. You know what you hear in AA meetings is you hear about this thing called alcoholic thinking. As if there really is such a thing. It's emotional immaturity. And we say, no, I have special thinking. It can't be. I have special thinking, and you need to consider that when you're dealing with me. I have special thinking. I think we're just immature, as painful as that might be. At meetings, don't criticize the leader. He has his own problems. This is 1941. The same shit was going on, you know? And is doing the best he can to solve them. Help him along by standing up and saying a few words. He will appreciate your kindness and thoughtfulness. Don't criticize the methods of others. Strangely enough, you may change your own ideas as you become older in sobriety. Remember, there are a dozen roads from Chicago to New York, but they all land in Chicago or something like that. How soon you will be cured of a desire to drink is another matter. That depends entirely upon how quickly you can succeed in changing your fundamental outlook on life. For as your outlook changes for the better, desire will become less pronounced until it disappears almost entirely. It may be weeks or it may be months. Your sincerity and your capacity for working with others on the AA program will determine the length of time. Here's the closer. Alcoholics Anonymous is based on a set of laws known as the 12 steps. Years of experience have definitely proved that those who live up to these rules remain sober. Those who gloss over or ignore any one rule are in constant danger of returning to a life of drunkenness. Thousands of words could be written on each rule. Lack of space prevents. So they are merely listed here. It is suggested that they be explained by the sponsor. If he cannot explain them, he should provide someone who can. Akron Manual. Has AA evolved from that? Yes. Is it a good thing? Mostly. Mostly. I think we've opened the door. We've allowed a lot of people in. We are not going to hospitals anymore, seeking them out and dragging them into meetings. They just come wandering in. Thousands of them all the time. They get sent here by the courts. They get sent here by their parents. You know, from recovery places, recovery houses. We are the world's aftercare program. You know, this is exactly what Bill Wilson wanted. Exactly. Matter of fact, I think he'd be happier. It's probably more than he ever thought would ever happen. He spent the last years in his life, and tonight I'll tell my story, but my father was involved in this, and Chuck Chamberlain and a bunch of people going to Washington lobbying Congress, trying to get them to open up funding for hospitals for recovery to stop putting alcoholics in prison and put them into recovery programs. They wanted validation from the federal government so the insurance companies would start treating it as an illness, as a disease, as the AMA recognized it in the early 50s. And that happened. The insurance companies jumped on the bandwagon. It was underwritten by the federal government. And all of a sudden, there were hospitals all over. All the alcoholics were going and getting jobs as counselors. Remember? Some of you remember. Still are, but there's not as much money in it anymore. And there arose an antagonistic relationship between these hospital programs and Alcoholics Anonymous. It became a war. It was not pretty. It was not good. I think Wilson was really rolling over in his grave when that happened. All of a sudden, we got our nose bent out of joint. We wouldn't sign the court cards. We didn't like the hospitals. They were dumping addicts in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's just not right. And there was a war sprang up. So pretty soon, the insurance companies quit funding it. Now you've got 12-step houses. You've got social model recovery places. And what do these places do? They use the meetings for their program. They use us for their program, which I think they should. We're the experts. The inmates are running the asylum, you know. Don Pritz, one of the trustees, a former trustee of Alcoholics Anonymous and died not too long ago, said a very powerful thing. He said, there are no issues in Alcoholics Anonymous that cannot be resolved through intelligent, informed sponsorship. We're the ones that know where we are. When they come in, I think we're the ones to describe where they are and what the rules are when they get here. And one breath will say, rules. You shouldn't say rules. But in the back of our heads, there are rules, aren't there? And some people come into AA and they don't follow the rules. And we get pissy, you know. A man by the name of Tom P. got sober in 1941, and he got tight with Wilson, and he ended up helping Wilson and AA edit the second edition to the Big Book and edit the 12 and 12. And he was an educated academic kind of guy, and he got really involved in this. And then he split off from Alcoholics Anonymous because he felt that we weren't adhering to the principles. And he founded his own little organization in upstate New York, and he called it All Addicts Anonymous. And they started doing things the correct way. They started eating correctly. They started adhering to certain rules the way he thought AA should be. My sponsor, Jay, actually visited this place a few years ago. Tom P. just has recently passed away. His son is now running it. And it was a group of trailers parked in the woods. And Jay came out and he goes, it was like Jamestown, man. It was scary. It was scary, man. Nobody was laughing very much, you know. It was a little icky. But in the 70s, they wrote a document that I think is really, really good. And it's called Gresham's Law. And Gresham's Law is an economic term. And what Gresham's Law says is that good money follows bad money. That when you start investing into something that isn't good, but you keep doing it long enough, pretty soon it becomes the standard. This is the way we do it. So the good money will follow it. And then everybody stands around and goes, what happened to our fortune? we were doing what we'd always done.
Well, this is something they wrote about Alcoholics Anonymous.
They applied this to Alcoholics Anonymous. And they talk about strong, medium, and weak program.
What's it look like? If we're losing our edge, where is it being lost? What have we lost? What is there? Is there some good stuff in the past that we've overlooked?
Have we really stepped away from the strength of Alcoholics Anonymous? Have we or haven't we? Break it down. So they broke it down. They looked at it and said, this is what we think.
It says, by now it is possible to distinguish three variant practices of the program, which we have labeled the strong cup of coffee, medium cup of coffee, and weak cup of coffee approaches. Strong AA is the original, undiluted dosage of spiritual principles. Strong AAs took all 12 steps.
Bill and Bob didn't know that you didn't have to do some of it and you could stay sober. They didn't know that. They thought you had to do it all.
I mean, they put the thing together and say, if you do all of this, you'll be okay.
They didn't know that you could do half of it and be cool. You know, they didn't know that.
Strong AAs took all 12 steps and kept on taking them. They did not stop with the admission of powerless over alcohol, but went on right away to turn their will and life over to God's care. They began to practice rigorous honesty in all their affairs. In short order, they proceeded to take a moral inventory, admit all of their wrongs to at least one other person, take positive and forceful action in making such restitution as was possible to those wrongs, continued taking inventory, admitting their faults, and making restitution on a regular basis, pray and meditate every day, go to two or more AA meetings weekly, and actively work the 12-step, carrying the AA message to others in trouble.
I think that's it, isn't it? That's pretty much it. If you're doing that, you're probably in a pretty good space, you know?
Medium. The medium AA started off with a bang, pretty much like the strong AAs, except they hedged or procrastinated on bits or parts of the program that they feared or did not like, maybe the God steps, maybe the inventory steps, depending on their particular nervousness or dislikes. But after they had stayed sober for a while, the medium AAs eased up and settled into a practice of the program that went something like this. An AA meeting a week, occasional 12-step work, leaving more and more of that on the newer fellows as time went on. Some work with the steps, but not like before. Less and less inventory as they became more and more respectable. That's painful. Some prayer and meditation still, but not on a daily basis anymore. Not enough time due to the encroachment of business engagement, social activities, and other baggage that went along with the return to normal life in the workaday world.
I think probably all of us, if we've been around a while, we've all done this. We've all kicked back a little, you know. I'm cool. I'm all right, you know. The weak AAs are a varied lot. The thing common to all of them was that they left big chunks of the program totally and permanently out of their reckoning right from the outset. Sometimes the God steps, sometimes the inventory steps, often both. Weak AAs tended to talk in terms like, all you need to do is stay sober, is go to meetings and stay away from the first drink. Most of the weak AAs who were successful in staying sober were pretty faithful meeting goers. Since they were doing so little with the principles, their sobriety and their survival depended more exclusively than those of the strong and medium AAs on constant exposure to the people of AA. I think the key to strong AA is sponsorship. I think the heart and soul of Alcoholics Anonymous is sponsorship. I don't think the meetings are AA. I think the meetings are fellowship. Meetings are good. I'm lucky. I like AA. I enjoy it. I did pretty much from the start, so it's fun to go. I like to be involved. I like to participate. But I think there's a big difference between activity and action. I think there's only one job in Alcoholics Anonymous, only one. That's working with others. There's only one form of 12-step work. There's only one, and that's working with others. There are not a lot of different forms of 12-step work. There aren't a lot of different ways that you can give back to the fellowship. There's only one. All the rest of it is activity, and all of the activity is wonderful. It's being part of a community. It's the fun part. But there's only one form of 12-step work. There's only one reason why you and I were saved. That's to help others. In a formal way. Not just driving them to meetings. Not just calling them up once in a while or accepting their phone calls, but sitting with them alone in a room somewhere, reading the book together, turning the pages, and working the steps together, alone. That's intimate. That scares the living bejesus out of most of us, that intimacy. We're all looking for it. We all want to be closer to each other, but we don't know how. This is the mechanism. This is it. This is the 80% of the program. 80% of the program of recovery is working with others. 20% is steps 1 through 9. It's sober 101. It's not the big deal. Working with others is the big deal. So if that is the big deal, how do you do it? What do you do? Are there rules? Are there rules? I think there's a few rules. I think never talking down to an alcoholic is a rule. I don't think we need to do that. We don't need to point our finger at them and say, put them in their place. You know, isn't that what's happened to us most of our lives? Is being put in our place? I think being a listener is important to the recovery process, to being a sponsor, learning how to listen and not just talk all the time. I will go through certain things when I'm sponsoring you. I will become your therapist. You will suck me into your drama, especially if it's really interesting. You know? And I will try to solve your problem for you. I'll really try. You know? I'll be your surrogate father. I'll hold you and rock you. I'll yell and scream at you if I think it might shake your tree, you know. Maybe this will get him to listen. When none of that works, I will then stop doing those things. You know? That's how I grow. That's how I grow up. That's how I learn how to interact with other human beings, is because I identify with you up front. Going into the process, I identify with you. You and I have been in the same incomprehensible, demoralized place. We've lost most everything, especially most things that are dear to us, even if it's not financially. So we identify with each other. And then we begin the process. Now, in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was no long-term sponsorship. There weren't any long-term sober people, you know. They didn't know that this would go on. Their idea of sponsorship was, you bring the guy into the meeting, you bring him into the fellowship, into the recovery process. You work the steps with him, usually in a day. In a day. They'd get it out of the way. You know, you write down some stuff, and they weren't so much into the columns and stuff, but I bet you some were. You know, some of them got into it. Some of the academic ones really broke it down, you know, and got into, well, you got to do it like this, you know. And so we come up with this format, and certainly that's what they put in the book. If you read the book, the four-step in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is pretty comprehensive. You have to kind of pore over it a little bit to find out what they were really getting at. But it's not a life story, is it? That's not what it's about. It's not the good and the bad, you know. You don't put yourself at the top of the amends list because you've been your own worst enemy. You know, you don't have to learn to love yourself before you can love others. You know, that kind. You don't take what you can use and leave the rest. You don't. All this crap has been. It's just my opinion, but it's really good. And you know, get that off the table. But none of that is in the book. And you can see what it's about. The sponsor should understand this. OK?
Okay? But what these guys did is they guided them through the process of the step, boom, 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 boom. And then sent them out. Abby Thatcher was 60 days sober. 60 days. Clearly, he was cured.
Yeah.
Clearly. Abby is cool. Go get him, Abby. Go get the worst one you know. This is Oxford Group. No AA. Oxford Group goes, you were a loser. Go find another one like you. You know, seemed apparent to them, didn't it? I mean, this was apparent. This is what you do. You know, you take somebody that was in the throes of alcoholism or gambling addiction or sexual addiction or whatever it was, food addiction, whatever they had that was going wrong, and when you cure them, you send them out to cure someone else. You drop the pebble in the water and boom, off it goes. This is ancient stuff. Abby showed up there 60 days sober and said, I've got religion. Scared the shit out of Wilson. You know, he's like, my God. It scared him so bad he got drunk and went looking for him. You know. So now, fast forward to us. I've had the same sponsor for 22 years. I don't want to break in another one. You know? He's younger than me and he's got a full head of hair. All of which pisses me off. You know. But that's the longest relationship I've ever had. 22 years I've been with that man. So now we've got this weird kind of relationship, the sponsor thing that goes on for a long time, and it's beyond just working the steps, isn't it? Things change in sobriety as we evolve. I'm emotionally immature. I drank through that part when I was a teenager. I got loaded and I missed it. I got sober at 37, almost 38 years old. With the emotional development of a 16-year-old. And this kid was not an honor student. He was the one with the bit of a problem with authority. And here he is, 6'5", 280 pounds, middle-aged, looks like he's grown up, but he's not. He's not. He walks in the room and you don't pay any attention to him and he gets all pissy. He walks in the room and you're looking at him and he gets all pissy. There's no way that he can't not be pissy, you know. So he starts working the steps. He works the steps and he does an inventory and he gets honest with this guy. And he makes some amends. My sponsor told me a couple of things that I think are very important. His job as my sponsor is to guide me through the process of the 12 steps so that I might find a power that's greater than myself that will solve my problems. He said, I'd be happy to talk to you about what you think your problems are so that you will not share about them in the meetings. The meetings are for recovery from alcoholism, not about how your day went. 22 years later, because I just believed him. I didn't know. And I just went to meetings and I went back and I reported. I said, you know, you're full of shit. They're talking about how their day went down there all the time. You know, what is this you're telling me? Because that's not what I'm experiencing in the meetings. He goes, AA is a safe place. You can say anything you want in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just giving you my opinion. What I see now is I see a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think what Wally sees and what the Back to Basics people see, what all they see is people using the meetings as their sponsor. People that don't have a sponsor or don't use one are not working the steps on a continual basis. Bring their problems to the meetings, which is never what it was supposed to be for, ever. This is the strong medium weak indication. Lots of people that use Alcoholics Anonymous as a support group, as a self-help program, as a refuge. And it is those things. It can be those things. But is it a very good one? No. It's the character defect center of the known universe.
There is no facilitator sitting there to help us work through our stuff. It's just us waiting our turn to share our crap. There is the illusion of intimacy because we talk about heavy shit. It's not intimate. It's just us talking about ourselves again and continually over and over and over. That horrible self-obsession, that horrible bondage of self. What my sponsor did for me and a group of people, my home group and stuff, is they said, get into action. Start driving them around. Start working with them. I started sponsoring people when I was 9 months sober. And I've been actively doing that for 22 years. I've gone to hospitals with you. I've watched your children be born. I've watched your children die. I've watched you die. I helped my parents die. I watched my friends get sick and recover. Some do, some don't. I've been called in the middle of the night to come and try to help you through a domestic dispute with your wife, which fortunately, just before I left the door, I called my sponsor. And he said, when you walk in there, what are you going to do? I had no clue, you know. And I didn't go. I called him up and I said, you know, come on over here. Why don't you get the hell out of the house and come over to my house, which is what he did. I want to tell you a quick story, and then maybe we can talk about some of this stuff, about technique and whatnot. When I was... maybe 2 years sober, this guy was standing in my kitchen, and he had left the phone number of my house to the hospital where his mother was dying, and he knew that he'd be there, so he left the phone number. And they called him, and they said, you better get back here. Looks like she's not going to make it. So he got up to leave, but he wasn't leaving. And I knew what he wanted, and I didn't want to go. You can find people in AA that will tell you that there's certain things that we don't have to do, that we're not qualified to do, that there's limitations on what we have to do, and you can draw those lines. I did not find those people. In the big book, there are no lines. You might have to loan money, you might let them sleep in your house. We suggest that doing this for very long isn't good because you begin to enable them. And if anybody's done this stuff, you've found yourself trying to talk them into being sober. Anybody here been successful at that? You know, maybe there's these little glimpses, but, you know, we can't really effectively be anybody's therapist. But we can be compassionate and empathetic. We can understand. I don't believe that you need to identify with me or I need to identify with you in order for me to sponsor you. They say, find someone you identify with. Well, if you're new in AA and you find someone to identify with, that's probably not the right person for you to be with. You know? I think that's some of the worst advice you could give anybody, you know. Our speaker last night talked about it. Gold, Mercedes, flashy. He identified with that. That was his first sponsor, you know. And you hear that story over and over and over again. Find someone that knows something, somebody that's pounding on the books, I mean, one of those guys that you don't particularly care for. It reminds you of your eighth grade math teacher, you know. Find that guy. He probably knows some shit, you know. He might be able to help you. I don't think there's any limitations on it. I think we go anywhere. If I've set up my life, if I truly believe that if I get on my knees and ask for help, that it will come, then I probably shouldn't send it away when it shows up. And it probably is not going to look like I think it's going to look like. I believe the vehicle God uses for us to address our character defects is sponsorship. You want to address your character defects? Sponsor people. You'll run into every one of them. Absolutely. You want to learn patience and tolerance? Don't ever fire them. Rule. Never fire them. You didn't hire them in the first place, did you? You know, how could you fire somebody? You're fired. There's an alcoholic behaving badly. Live mini-cam report.
You know, you didn't do what I said. Oh, my God, you're fired.
I mean, some people think I'm arrogant, but I have my limitations. You know, I mean, firing people is just beyond, I can't conceive of it. Plus the fact, my experience is you don't have to fire them. They just leave. Just because I don't fire you doesn't mean I have to be nice to you. You know, I can be disdainful. I can look at you and go, you live like a pig. You know, why do you still dress like that? I'll say things like that. You're 10 years sober. You look like a homeless guy. What's up with that? You know, people, you want that kind of reaction, you know, they'll move on to somebody else. We have one guy that comes to mind that is working his way around the Hermosa Beach bin stag trying to find somebody that says it's okay to live like a pig when you're 11 or 12 years sober. No, it's not. So I don't think there are any limitations. If you're a drug addict and I'm not, is that reason enough to turn you down if you ask me to sponsor you? I don't think you have any problem being a drug addict, do you? You don't need any help with me about drug addiction. You know, guy walked up to me one time and he says, would you be my sponsor? I think I should tell you I'm gay. And I said, wouldn't you rather have a gay sponsor? He looked at me and goes, no. He says, I don't have any problem being gay. Drinking is an issue, though. You know. Well, of course, you know. Who cares? This woman came up to me. I did this rant. She says, this girl asked me to sponsor her, and she's a cocaine addict. And I've never done cocaine, so I told her no. What do you think? And I go, well, you're never going to learn about cocaine addiction now because God sent you that woman, and you sent her away. You know. And what does she need to know about cocaine addiction? Doesn't she want recovery? Don't we know about recovery? I will take anybody through the 12 steps. It's not up to me to decide whether you're correctly alcoholic enough for me to work with. You know, if I'm going to get good at this, I'm going to need a lot of different kinds of people to come in my life. What about people on medication? Do you know that people actually turn people away? Won't help them. Can you believe that? People walk up and say, will you help me? I'm bipolar and I'm on medication. And they go, no, I don't work with people on medication. How can you say that? I mean, where do you think you are? What do you think this is? Do you really want the hand of AA to be there when anybody, anywhere, anytime reaches out? Is that true or not? It's not up to me to decide. I'll work with anybody. And if they come up and we start working and it doesn't work, maybe they need to hang on to me for a little while before they find the right person to be with. Maybe I'm a stopgap measure. That's happened to me a lot. You know? And then they find somebody that they really identify with, you know? And off they go. Off they go. Maybe I kept them around for a while. Who knows? It's not up to me to decide. I'm not running the show. You know? God has not instilled me with the wisdom to filter you out. So this guy's standing in my kitchen and he won't leave. So I said, do you want me to go with you? And he said, would you please? Now, he has a family, brothers and sisters and stuff like that. But for some reason, they trust us more than their own family. Isn't that interesting? I wonder what that is. You know? So I went with him and it was awful. I mean, she was all hooked up to tubes and stuff and I was shocked. I'd never seen anything like that before. I'd never seen anybody die. And I sat in a chair next to the bed, and I got quiet. And this feeling came over me. And the feeling was, everything's okay, Bill. There's nothing wrong here. This isn't a mistake. Just relax. So I brought my friend over, and I sat him down next to me, and we held hands. We said a prayer together, and I looked at him, and I said, everything's okay, Al. There's nothing wrong. It's all right. And he was holding onto my hand, really. He's a great big guy like me, and he was really had a tight grip. And when we were praying, I could feel his hand relax in my hand. That's intimacy. That's intimacy. And I miss it all the time. I'm looking for a head rush. And most emotions are very quiet and subtle. And I miss them. And I never would allow myself to be in a position to experience anything like that. If it had been my choice, I would have said no to him in the kitchen. Okay? So what I have to do is I have to live by a couple of rules. Always answer the phone and never say no. No caller ID. I don't filter who comes into my life anymore. I'm powerless. My life's unmanageable. You just come. Just come. All the time. My experience is I'll never be given more than I can handle, but I will definitely get my ass maxed out. You know? That's my wife calling. I should answer it, huh?
No. Well, you don't get the
calls. I'm right in the middle of doing a workshop. You want to say hi to all the people?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. See you later. She said, "You idiot." That was too perfect. She just celebrated 17 years sobriety. So I miss it all the time. I miss these things. And I have to be put in situations that I'm uncomfortable in. Situations that I don't understand, that I don't know the rules. I don't know how to speak the language. Sponsorship does that for us. You will invite me into your life when I don't really want to go. I'm afraid. I'm uncomfortable. I don't know how to behave. And that's when the experiences happen. That's when it begins to happen. That's what happened to Bill and Bob. That's what happened to them. Bob worked with, what, 5,000 people, they estimate, in the 15 years he was sober? 5,000 people, my God. How do you do that? One at a time. One at a time. After my friend Al's experience with his dying mother, my friend Chris Gantner had an 8-year-old son that caught leukemia. Took him 2 years to die. And we went in that hospital near the end almost every day to sit with our friend. We stood around the little boy's bed and held hands and prayed for his death. Because it was just... And my children are the same age. I was in that hospital one time. I started having heart palpitations. And they ran me up to the cardiac care unit. I couldn't deal with it. It was just too much for me, you know. And my friend Chris, whose son was dying, came up to visit me. He goes, "This is the most shameless ploy for the center of attention I have ever seen in my life."
Yeah.
Only in AA, you know. In the midst of a dying child, can you give your buddy some shit, you know. And the little boy died. And I know what would happen if one of my children died now. Because I'm just like Chris. It was hell. It was horrible. He lived. He has 2 more children now. You know, he lived. He survived it, which is unbelievable. I mean, that's the worst thing you can imagine. My friend Patrick Keelahan that I got sober with, whose mother called him the devil of all liars. He was a little Irish, and he was an awful person, really. And he got sober. He got lung cancer. And we... took him on retreat with us a couple of times. He had an open wound in his back to use to drain the fluid from his lungs. The doctor showed us how to pack the wound so that we could get him out of the hospital and take him on retreat. Took meetings to his house. I was there when he died. And I lost my friend. My father came to me when he was 85 years old back in 1999. He says, "I've got cancer and I'm not going to do the chemotherapy. And I'm going to go for the ride." And I was ready. You had made me ready. I'd seen the face of death. And we went for the ride. My mother and I nursed him. And my father was sober 45 years. And we had a great memorial for him. There's some funny stuff that happened when he was dying. But I was ready. My mother and I changed his diapers, you know, and took care of him. I hated my father, which is a requirement for being an alcoholic, you know. And we had made amends, and then we gave each other birthday cakes for 14 years in the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag. And I found my dad. And then he died. Like happens, it happens to us. We die. And I was ready. And I'll tell you something. When he was dying, I didn't feel required to make it about me. When I was going through the experiences with Al, and with my friend Chris with the kid, and with my friend Patrick, it was about me. Part of my motivation for going there is because I wanted you to think well of me. That I'm a member in good standing of AA. Bill, he'll go into the hospital. And I reveled in that. I liked the ego of being a good guy and being thought of as a good guy. When the little boy was dying and I was having heart palpitations, was it about me? Absolutely. Look what Bill's going through. He's walking into the hospital again and he's taking care of Chris. And he's look, and you know how they say, do something nice for somebody and then don't tell anybody? I don't think I've ever done that. If I don't tell people, it didn't really happen. You know, because I'm ego-driven. I'm a newcomer in AA and I'm ego-driven. You can't find humility by pretending to be humble. When a kid grows up in the teenage years, he goes through experiences that deepen him emotionally. And he does a bunch of dumb things. He's awkward and gawky and geeky and he has fears and he's, you know, he's motivated by self. I mean, how else could it be? By the time he's 25 years old, he pretty much comes out of that mostly, don't you think? I mean, if they're healthy, by the time they're 25, they're fairly well balanced. By the time they hit 30, they're a fairly decent person, not totally driven by self. They're able to absorb and take other people into their lives, and part of their own personality is these other people. How does that happen for us in Alcoholics Anonymous? We walk into the hospital and pretend that we're selfless. Emotional honesty is a bitch. You know, I'm motivated by self. When my father got sick, I was much less motivated by self because I felt the pain of being motivated by self in these previous experiences. I mean, how shallow can I continue to be? If I have some awareness, if I'm living some sort of an examined life, I can see this stuff and go, ooh, I don't like that part. That's not cool, you know. By the time my father got sick, I was ready. It was about him. It wasn't about me. It was about him. My mother got sick. After that, my mother moved in with me. And she got sick at 85. And I nursed her by myself and changed her diapers. And it was a remarkable experience. Something I wouldn't trade for anything in the world. And you all showed up during my father and my mother. You all showed up. Now, I ask you a question. What if I would have said no to that man in my kitchen? What if somebody comes up to me and asks me for help or for something and I say no? Do I fully understand the ramifications of that decision? No. I don't think we get it. You know? And when we limit ourselves, we limit ourselves. We are limited to the experience that we decide that we're going to have. If I don't want to be uncomfortable, nothing will ever change. You know? Sponsorship is the vehicle. It's how we address our character defects. I will see myself through your eyes much better than I will ever discover it on my own. Much better than any inventory after inventory after inventory. You will show me better than I could ever see it. So, I have a question for you. Should everybody sponsor? Good. You passed. You know, some people say no. You know, everybody shouldn't sponsor, that there's other things to do. I think those are part of the lies we tell ourselves. Those are our own insecurities. And I need to lean into that kind of stuff. You know? I think that you will draw me into your drama many times when I'm working with you. I will get sucked into what's going on in your life. As time has gone by, I get less sucked in. I get less invested in your recovery. I'm not invested so much in your recovery. The success rate, the operative term in the 75% success rate, is those who really tried. Those who really tried. My success rate in sponsoring people with those who really tried is higher than 75%. The ones who really tried, the guy Al in my kitchen, he's like Jay and I. I've been his only sponsor for 20 years. Everybody thanks me. Thank you, Bill, for taking Al off of our hands. You know, Al's a little weird, you know, but I think Al thinks I'm a little weird. You know, but I've got guys I've sponsored for a long time. They really tried. What do we talk about now? We talk about sponsoring guys. I have a guy, Mike, that calls me up and he goes, I have a problem of abundance. Can I whine to you about it? Sometimes I tell him no. At least he's identified it correctly, you know. He actually owns a house. That's pretty remarkable for this guy, you know. So now he has homeowners' problems, you know, repair issues. You know, he has no money. I said, you have no money because you have a wife and a house. You're not supposed to have any money. It's the way it works, you know. Get with the program. You know? But the things we talk about is working with others and where we're going and what we're doing. You can tell when somebody's starting to get well when they call you up and they talk about someone else besides themselves. If it's true that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem, then I think we need to get out of ourselves and into other human beings. And the mechanism that God uses for us to do that with is sponsorship. What about people on medication? Two things in closing. There's two big issues. The thing about AA, is it effective or not? It has been inundated with just all kinds of people. Every one of us, if we've been around here long enough, we've met people in AA that aren't really alcoholics. If you sit down and you talk to them about it, this one guy asked me to sponsor him. He says, I've never really been drunk. I went, why are you here? Well, my therapist sent me here, said it would be good for my social skills. So I'm looking at him and I thought, now this is one you get to say no. This is like over the edge. I said, all right, I'll do it. But don't tell anybody. And I told him, I said, don't share in meetings. You have nothing to share. So just sit and listen. So I worked the steps with him. And his inventory was mostly about relationships that he'd had, previous relationships with women. And this guy rode bicycles. And I was just getting in. I'd lost 100 pounds. And I was getting healthy. And I was riding bicycles. And I was trying to get competitive. And I wanted to ride the Solvang Century. And I couldn't find anybody to go with me. And he heard me talking about it. He goes, I'll go with you. I'll ride with you. I said, okay. So he went with me. At about mile 70, when we come around this bend, and I look up and there's one more hill, and my heart sank, my ego rose up in all of its glory and said, quit. You know you're a loser. Just quit. You've quit many times. Quit again, you know. And this guy was next to me, and Ed Spaulding. He said, what are you doing? I said, man, I don't think I can. He said, oh, come on, you can do it. Come on, I'll go, I'm staying with you. Come on, let's go. Rest for a while, come on. And he started giving me instruction. He says, keep your legs moving, don't let them cramp up. You're going to be all right, you can make it. So I'm going up this hill, and he goes, get off the bike, get off. I go, well, we're going. He says, just get off the bike, take a breath. You know, it's not a competition. We're dead last anyway, you know. So I got off, I rested, and we made it up over the top of the hill, and we finished it. Now, why do you suppose he was sent to me? Was it for me to help him? I don't have a clue. I don't get it. What if I would have turned him away? I don't know. You know, I think they all get to come. They all get to come and let God sort them out. You know, we all say that stuff, but they all get to come. Is that her again? Sorry. So in closing on this thing, if I get on my knees and I ask for help, when it comes, I shouldn't send it away. And it's going to look a lot like you. You are the mechanism God uses to work my program, to confront my character defects, to become a better husband and a better father. You're how he works. You teach me these things. And I don't understand what's going on. I don't understand. And I think I understand, but I truly don't. If in the first step I admit that I'm powerless and I'm unmanageable, the second step becomes operative. I need a new manager. The third step, I give him the job. The fourth step, I list the job. The fifth step, I make a ceremony out of, here, you take these things. I don't want them anymore. 6 and 7 are two paragraphs in the book because there's nothing for me to do and I don't fully understand it anyway. But I can see the character defects in the fourth column of the resentment list. I can pick them out pretty good. And as time goes by, they become clearer and clearer and clearer. As I continue with 10-step and continuing inventory, I can see what these things are. The manager gives me my next job. He says, make a list of people you've injured and go about the process of making amends so that I can have enough self-esteem that I won't be afraid to look at myself anymore. The 11th step, it would behoove me to get close to whatever it is that saved my life. The 12th step is what it's all about. The rest of my life, I'm going to be interacting with you. I'm going to learn how to be a lover. I'm going to learn how to be a husband. I'm going to learn how to be a father. I'm going to learn how to be close. I'm going to learn to love fearlessly, recklessly, and let you all in. The people I don't like are the most significant because it's touching something in me that I don't care for in myself. If I really want to be a loving, true human being someday in this life, then I need to let you in. I can't recover without you. You are an integral part of my recovery. And the closer I am to you, the closer I am to God. God lives in the space between you and I. Thank you for coming today.